H.G. Adler, witness and storyteller to the Holocaust.
At the beginning and at the end, we are storytellers, and Adler felt that we have to find a way to tell stories about this and to tell them in complicated, fantastical, rich, deeply layered ways.
That's Peter Filkins talking about his translation of H.G. Adler's novel, Panorama. We'll spend most of the hour with Filkins, first on Panorama and second on Adler's novel, The Journey. That's all coming up on today's Writer's Voice. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. In 2008, we spoke with award-winning translator Peter Filkins about H.G. Adler's novel, The Journey, the first of three based on Adler's life. Its subject was a family caught in the vise of the Holocaust and sent to Theresienstadt. Now, Filkins has translated the second in the trilogy, Panorama. It's constructed as a series of discrete windows into the life of its protagonist, Josef. The novel begins by recreating the vanished world of Bohemia, then part of the Austro-Hungarian Empire. We follow Josef as he moves from childhood in a middle-class Jewish family in Prague, through his youth, then as a forced laborer under the German occupation, and then an inmate in the camps. What emerges is a kind of Joycean portrait of the artist as a young man, Filkins says, that illuminates Josef's deepening moral sense as the compass to the dissolving world around him. Peter Filkins, welcome to Writer's Voice again.
Thank you. It's nice to be here.
And we are welcoming you here on the occasion of the publication of your second translation of a work by H.G. Adler. When did Adler die, actually?
1988.
Okay. Now, the first time we talked to you, we spoke to you about his book, The Journey.
Yes.
Which was a novel in many ways that was autobiographical, just as Panorama is autobiographical.
Yes.
I mean, there were some differences. Tell us about Adler. Where was he from? Give us the brief bio of him.
Well, he was born in 1910 in Prague. Grew up, was educated at the university there, did a doctorate in musicology, and was hoping to become a professor and a writer, and in 1938 tried to get out of Prague as the Nazis began to move in, never managed to, and eventually in 1942 was deported along with his wife to Theresienstadt. And eventually lived there, was there for 2.5 years, and then eventually was shipped on to Auschwitz, Buchenwald, and a neighboring camp of Buchenwald called Langenstein. Survived the entire experience, lost his wife, her parents, his parents, 18 family members. Eventually made it back to Prague in 1945, tried to begin again there, but saw that the communists were going to take control of the government and decided to leave Prague in 1947 for London, where he lived for the rest of his life, the next 40 years, writing novels, social science, history, his great study of Theresienstadt, which is 1,000 pages long, wrote 6 novels, but lived on the margins of German letters, was primarily unknown in his lifetime.
And you really have brought him to light by your translations, at least in this country.
Well, that's true. I stumbled upon The Journey back in, about 2000 or so, and immediately was attracted to it, particularly to the voice of the novel and his writing style, which is very modernist, very layered with multi-voiced and containing many different kinds of perceptions at once, particularly in The Journey, and was very attracted to the style of the novel. And when Random House published it in 2008, it gave Adler a sort of second chance at being recognized for the complicated writer that he was. And I'm really pleased that since then there are now translations in Spanish, Italian, French, and Hebrew.
Now, when you talk about the voice, you make a comparison between him and W.G. Sebald, who did not go through the war, but was German and also lived in England. He happens to be one of my favorite writers.
Mine too.
What are the connections in the way that they both write? And do you think that that has something to do with the language that they wrote in or the culture that What do they share?
I think they kind of arrive at the same destination from two different directions. Perhaps they arrive at the same crossroads from different directions. Sebald is writing as a writer who didn't go through the war, who didn't, of course, go through the Holocaust or the camps, but nonetheless a German deeply troubled by that history and the lack of discussion of it or the inability to discuss it. Adler is a survivor of the camps and is also writing as a German speaker and is trying to figure out what is his identity as victim, as survivor, as writer. At the end of the day, he simply wanted to be a writer. Unfortunately, this was the material that was handed him, and he wanted to do justice to it. He wanted to do justice to those who were not there to have survived, to do justice to it. So it's a different kind of burden for Adler. The real crossroads for them is, of course, in Sebald's Austerlitz. At the end of Austerlitz, Austerlitz, the main character, comes back to London and wants to read about Theresienstadt, and he reads Adler's Theresienstadt book. And it's a 12-page long sentence in the German where he meditates on Adler and what he learns from that book. So you can see there that clearly Sebald was pointing towards Adler. It was as if Sebald says, I can take you so far, but if you really want to go farther, you're going to have to go to Adler. And I feel that's what Adler does, not better, in some ways different, but just takes us just all the further into the experience itself.
Because he's taking us into the consciousness of someone who's actually gone through it?
Absolutely. That's been the attraction for me, is the way that Adler is interested in rendering the consciousness of his characters, not just their experience. Particularly in The Journey, it is very layered, and you often don't even know who is speaking or who is saying what, whether it's a guard or one of the family members or one of the other prisoners. Whereas in Panorama, we have Joseph Kramer, who is the protagonist, and we see him grow up as a boy around 1910, born in Prague, and eventually make it to England after he comes out of the camps, which of course parallels Adler's story. But it's really about how Joseph thinks about what happens to him as opposed to what happens to him. And it reminds me in that way a great deal of Joyce, of a book like Portrait of the Artist as a Young Man. This is in some ways a portrait of a young man who is wanting to become an artist, but who is thrown into this experience instead.
This maelstrom. Now, as you say, it begins during World War I, really, in Prague. Josef is a young Jewish boy. It begins actually in a panorama.
Right.
The title of the book is Panorama. His aunt has taken him to this. Describe where they are, what it's like, what the attraction is for him.
Well, he's a little boy. He's 5 years old, and it's a great treat to go to the panorama, which is the predecessor to the cinema. It was a polyhedron wooden cabinet where you could go inside, and postcards of places like the pyramids and Niagara Falls would pass by. And his grandmother takes Josef to the panorama, and this is the big treat for the week, and the show changes every week. A different country is featured. And he's just absolutely taken with this and is lost, finds himself lost into these images, these pictures of otherworldly places that he would love to see and love to visit. And then that's the little sort of kind of forward to the book, just a brief passage. And then the book then consists of 10 different scenes from Josef's life as he moves through life.
As if they are the sections of a panorama.
Very much. I mean, there's not a... each scene is distinct from the other. Each chapter is distinct from the other. There's not a continuous narrative from chapter to chapter. It's Joseph at 8, Joseph at 14, Joseph at 18, Joseph at 23, as he moves through. And there's constant references back to the motif of the panorama and how life is a kind of panorama which presents us with scenes that we are part of, but also not part of, because we're individual beings outside of experience as well.
Now, he's really describing a world that is completely lost to us in the early pages of this. And yet it does hold intimations of what is to come, describe that world, you know, maybe not in the detail, of course,
right,
that this novel does, but what is different about it? What is about to change?
Well, this is the world of Bohemia, of the region of Czech, what we now know as Czechoslovakia, which is, Bohemia is still the largest province of Czechoslovakia. But Bohemia was a kingdom of its own for 1,000 years. And there's a very deep sense of rootedness for Josef in growing up in Bohemia. And the beginning of the novel, and really the first two-thirds of the novel, are about simply his growing up in that world, living in the farm, on a farm in the countryside.
And how does he get there? I mean, he's a young Jewish urban boy. How does he get to a farm?
Well, there's trouble in the family. The family's quite anxious. There's a lot of strife. And this was true of Adler's life. It came to a point where the family decided it was simply best for him to live with another family as a kind of foster child for a while. And so he leaves the city and goes to the countryside to live with this farming family and loves it. Nature is always a place of safety and freedom in Adler, because nature doesn't know history. Nature just knows life itself. And that's always a place that Josef feels at home. There's another chapter where he's with a scouting troop and hiking in the countryside. And that's a moment where these boys are taking trains to the countryside to go on a trip. And there are chilling moments. You realize those same boys 10 years later are going to be riding different trains, be they as prisoners or as guards or citizens in the country who know about such trains. So there's a way in which everything that happens to Josef is kind of in the present, but also foreboding to the future as well. And so he kind of lives his life, but also doesn't live his life. His life lives his life for him, if you will, which is kind of true for all of us. I mean, we all pass through life and we think we're in control, but there are larger forces at work, be they history, be they certain happenstance and circumstances that we can't control. And this is as true for Josef, too.
And it isn't just living life, but living a life that is about to be destroyed,
yeah,
and then living through the utter destruction of that life.
Yes, I mean, that's the other poignancy of the novel, I think, is that Bohemia will disappear. It will be swallowed up by Czechoslovakia. And Josef, as a German-speaking Jew in Prague, there was a whole culture of subset of Prague society, which was Jewish German-speaking, and that just is wiped out in the war. And so Josef is, as was Adler, a kind of representative man of his age. You're talking about an entire strata of society that simply disappeared. And this is the world of Franz Kafka. This is the German Jewish German-speaking world of the Prague circle of writers, which Kafka is, you know, the central figure of, and Adler considered himself a direct literary descendant of Kafka. I don't think it's any accident that it's Joseph Kramer is the protagonist of this novel.
Joseph K.
Joseph K., exactly.
From the trial.
Very conscious, I think, on Adler's part. And whereas Joseph K. from the trial is a kind of allegorical, metaphorical figure, Joseph Kramer is an actual figure. Joseph K. goes through an allegorical nightmare. Joseph Kramer goes through an actual nightmare and lives to tell about it on the other end.
We're talking with Peter Filkins. His new translation of H.G. Adler's novel, Panorama, is coming out this week. Is that right?
Today. It's
coming out today,
yeah,
as we're speaking today. This is the 18th,
yes,
of January. Well, that's very exciting. I was very intrigued also, before we get to the point where things really begin to fall apart, where Josef is in high school and he becomes a member of the Wandervogel.
Yes.
This is a youth movement that swept throughout the German-speaking lands, but also was, I mean, in the United States, we know it as the Boy Scouts.
Right.
It was throughout Europe. A very interesting movement of young people who really saw themselves as differentiated from the adults who had gone through World War I, who had created World War I, you know, who they really saw as not being trustworthy. They were going to build a new world.
Right. Yes, there's a great deal of idealism, and Josef is seduced by that. There is that distinct feeling of the parents having been a flawed generation, as so often young people do feel about their parents or their the generation that precedes them until they grow up themselves. And you see this young scout troop wanting to, Josef even thinks that they want to be better. The world will be better if it lived more like the scout troop, sort of self-reliant and cooperative and not being seduced by the pleasures of the flesh or whatever, but
materialism or consumerism.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. But rather returning to a kind of natural world. The place that they travel to is Adam's Freiheit, which is Adam's freedom, which literally you can read the paradise, I mean, that they're mm-hmm. returning to. And there's hope that they will be the better generation. Of course, they become the generation that suffers as equal, if not even a greater cataclysm. And again, that's the poignancy. They can't see it coming, even though they are trying to change it, even though they're trying to prevent something that isn't even there yet. But they're not going to be allowed to. They too will be swallowed up in the cataclysm.
And how does Josef process this as things begin to fall apart? He goes to work on a railroad as a forced laborer. This is before he himself is transported to the camps. And already there, he has a conversation with a Dr. Ziegler.
Yes.
In which they go into some of how the victims of cataclysm, as you call it here, how they confront it, how do they try to make sense of it, how they try to continue living within it.
Yes, no, that's a critical conversation. Ziegler has reached a point of kind of no return, of despondency, of feeling that there is no hope, all one can do is just sort of bear one's self through it. And Josef is close to that point, but he develops a kind of readiness, what he calls a readiness to accept, a willingness to accept what is given him. And that he doesn't, at the end of the day, doesn't despair. He believes that there is a form of hope in simply going on, in not being pessimistic, in continuing to observe what is going on around him. It's a key element of Adler. When Adler went to Theresienstadt, immediately he told himself, if I can simply get down the facts of this experience, I will have a better chance of surviving it. And he took hundreds and hundreds of pages of notes on his experience. In fact, when he came back from Langenstein, he passed through Theresienstadt in order to pick up the briefcase that Leo Beck had saved for him. I've actually seen it in his archive in Germany.
Oh, tell us who Leo Beck was and how did this happen? This seems like an amazing story in itself.
Leo Beck was the head of Jewish society and religion in Germany. I mean, he was the
chief rabbi.
Yeah, the chief rabbi of Germany, and deeply, deeply respected. Also was in Theresienstadt with Adler. And when Adler was shipped off, Beck was still there, and Adler took his notes to Beck, saying, please try to preserve them if you can. Beck survived, and Adler came back to pick up the notes from him. So you have this kind of wonderful, strange, eerie circumstance of Adler, you know, being able to retrieve his past through the notes that he had taken and all those observations. They would then go on to become his Theresienstadt book.
And you've seen this? Where does a suitcase for?
It's in his archive is in Marbach, Germany, and I was at a conference there because it's Adler's centenary was just last year, 2010, and there was a conference there for it. And they had a little exhibit, and there was this black briefcase, a soft leather, big sort of suitcase kind of thing. And you realize out of that suitcase came the next 40 years of Adler's life, and again, these memories and this the residue of this experience as one of the very few German-speaking Jews who survived the camps and went on to write fiction about it. I mean, there's just a handful of them.
And so he is the victim as a witness, and through witness, he is Is he able to make sense of his experience?
Well, yes and no. I think the question there is, who is the he? Josef continues to struggle, trying to make sense of his experience.
The character.
But then you, of course, have Adler on the outside of the character, who is shaping the character. So there are moments when Josef feels he can't bring it about. In the end, he does feel that he's able to somehow organize this experience in his head, in his thoughts. But, of course, it's Adler who is writing the novel, which is telling us that Josef feels that. So it's really Adler who is organizing and able to sort of wrap a frame around his experience by writing the novel itself.
Now, you have your book open here, so I have a feeling that you'd like to read us a section. Is that right?
Sure. Do you have a section you'd like me to read?
Yes, because this conversation that we're talking about, the conversation with Dr. Ziegler, it's on page 343.
Yeah, that's the page I'm at.
Oh, okay. and actually, on that page, there's a section in the middle and also at the end. So maybe you could just read down that. And,
sure.
Yeah.
In Dr. Ziegler's eyes, the world is going to pieces, such that the only thing that can be sensibly described is what we each experience alone, all people today becoming more and more enslaved because there is nothing to prevent it from happening. Josef wants to know what could prevent it, and Ziegler says it's the strength of the unmediated life, which is a strength that develops within, much as ancient mystics taught, but this strength can unfold only when technological capability is not turned into an instrument of power by the politicians.
And can I stop you there?
Sure.
Because I want to ask you about this. What does he mean by the strength of the unmediated life?
A life which is simply lived day to day, lived purely, lived, responds to experiences, not mediated through the roles that society assigns us, that our jobs assign us,
that propaganda,
or increasingly technology. I mean, think of how our lives are mediated by Facebook and email, and in other words, how much of our lives are controlled by having to be attached to those technological developments, telephones, television, all of these things, of course, would come later. But Adler could see this already, that society was starting to technologically control individuals. And so an unmediated life is one that can live outside the bounds of that technology.
Okay.
Yeah. Ziegler doesn't believe this process can be stopped, not even through revolution. Only a complete cataclysm could do so, though that would also mean the destruction of all achievements of culture and civilization. And should this fate come to pass, all that a human being is currently capable of is to produce the courage and tragic desire for his own demise in order that at least a heroic end is achieved.
You're listening to Writer's Voice, and we're talking with Peter Filkins about his translation of H.G. Adler's novel, Panorama. It was published in the original German in 1988, the year of Adler's death, and has just been issued in English by Random House. And again, I'm trying to understand this too, because part of me says that, well, can there really be an unmediated life, A? And B, is this a kind of romantic notion that, you have the pure individual standing against society who, unable to do anything to change society, will just heroically put an end to himself?
Well, again, I think that's Ziegler's view. That's mm-hmm. not Josef's view. And I think Adler is pointing that it is an overly romanticized version, that Josef is more cooperative than that. He depends upon others. Others depend upon him. He cares for many of the inmates in the bunks and the camps. He's an older prisoner himself. He watches out for the younger workers on the railroad and for the younger prisoners in the camp as well.
And in fact, he says later on, this is Josef, he says, much can be withstood by sheer will because one cannot give in and succumb to each day's demands, but instead must remember what's needed to supersede such hardship. This is when he's in the camp. Be it a friendly word or a bit of encouragement for a neighbor in the room on the way to work, as both provide strength to the slave. Now, this is an extraordinary sentence. I felt what I took from it is that he's saying one survives by being kind to others.
Yes. No, I think that's very true, that And he doesn't mean this in some kind of, I don't know, sort of soft-hearted
anodyne.
Way. Yeah, no. That's that the rituals of kindness, the rituals of human exchange, the rituals of watching out for one another are part of the fabric of humanity that is embedded in society, that is part of an unmediated life. In other words, to try to live life with others and through others, but not get caught up in the roles and the assignments and the bureaucracies and the structures that society foists upon us. That to be kind to one another is to be human to one another.
It reminds me of Victor. I'm sorry for interrupting you, but it reminds me of Viktor Frankl's work. Man's Search for Meaning was his book that came out of the camps, and, you know, where Frankl said it is precisely in kind of remaining human that you can survive. And yet there is another view of the camps, which was the only people who survived were those who were ruthless.
Well, yes, but I think, again, Adler's is saying the first, that you may have survived the camps by being ruthless, but what survived, I think, is the question Adler would ask. That what's important to Josef and to Adler is not only to survive physically the camps, but to survive as a human being, to come out the other end and still be a person who has gone through this experience and been shaped and affected by this experience, but is still outside of this experience, isn't a prisoner to it for the rest of his life.
And so then, I interrupted you so much, but on the same page, a little bit further down, here it is. I guess there's another conversation, another person here, Simon or Simone.
Yeah.
Why don't you go from that paragraph?
Simon says. Mm-hmm. Simon says that you might as well commit suicide. He's saying this to Ziegler. But Ziegler smiles at this, saying that that's too easy. For as Grab says, at the end of a tragedy, we do not fall out of the world once we are already in it. And so life, in a certain sense, is an eternal process from whose clutches not even suicide frees us, which Grab's hero knew. The views of philosophers from Heraclitus to Nietzsche aside, we indeed learn from fate, if only in the sense that we learn that life continues on despite its dissolution, and that in truth, man cannot cut himself off from it, but instead must immerse himself, meaning that he may indeed be a victim, but he is also a witness, and through that each can, whether through his own disposition or caprice, find a certain freedom, namely the freedom of knowledge or the ability to know.
And to make meaning thereof.
Very much. I mean, that's, you know, that ability to observe, that ability to take in experience and yes, to make meaning, which is what literature does, what novels do, what writing studies of history do as well. Adler wanted to do it in two ways. He wanted to do it in an artful way and in a scientific research. He thought that was key to look at both precisely what happened, but also how we interpret what happened.
Now, there are those who say that the Holocaust has no meaning, and that you cannot make art of it, that in fact it's, you know, in some way to deny what the Holocaust is, to try to find meaning or to try to make art of it. What do you think Adler would have thought of those arguments?
Well, this was a key element in his life. Of course, the famous statement from Theodor Adorno to say to write poetry after Auschwitz is barbaric. He didn't, by the way, say you couldn't write poetry. He just said it was barbaric to write poetry. And Adler and he directly corresponded on this, and Adler believed, no, you have to use everything you have to try and get at this experience. You have to use fiction, you have to use nonfiction, you have to use research, you have to use memoir, you have to use personal experience, all of these elements. And Adorno, they sort of fought bitterly about this in letters, and Adorno won the day. And
you mean
the larger world? I mean, Adorno had such a profound influence on the shaping of post-war German letters. And this is very much why Adler's works were so neglected. It took 11 years for his first novel to appear. It took 20 years for Panorama to appear. And people weren't ready for novels about the Holocaust. And Adler firmly believed that this is part of about I think, goes back to coming out of the camps as a human being. That one, to come out and say it is impossible to tell stories about this, it is impossible to imagine, create imaginary tales about this, is to forfeit one's humanity. At the beginning and at the end, we are storytellers. And Adler felt that we have to find a way to tell stories about this and to tell them in complicated, fantastical, rich, deeply layered ways, not simply novels that are really memoirs in disguise.
Well, Peter Filkins, your terrific translation.
Thank you.
Of a terrific novel, Panorama. The novel is by H.G. Adler. It's going on sale today as we do this interview, January 18th. Thanks so much for talking with us here.
Thank you, Francesca.
Peter Filkins, translator of H.G. Adler's novels, Panorama and The Journey. Filkins is also a poet. His work has appeared in, among others, The New Republic, The American Poetry Review, The Massachusetts Review, and The New York Times. We'll air an excerpt from our 2008 interview with Filkins about The Journey after the break, and you can read an excerpt from Panorama, which has just been published, at writersvoice.net. That was music from Overture for Small Orchestra by Hans Krause. He was a musician interned in Theresienstadt. He died there in 1944. And he is the composer of the famous children's opera, Brundibar. Welcome back to Writer's Voice. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. In the first half of our show, we spoke with translator Peter Filkins about H.G. Adler's novel, Panorama. Let's hear an excerpt from our interview with Filkins in 2008 about the first novel in Adler's trilogy, The Journey, which Filkins also translated. The book is set largely in Theresienstadt, where H.G. Adler himself was sent before being deported to Auschwitz.
And it's in 1942 that he's deported to Theresienstadt, which is not a concentration camp, but a enforced slave community or ghetto, which the Nazis created, as was it's often referred to as Hitler's gift to the Jews, in this sardonic euphemism, because the deal that was offered was that in exchange for apartments and worldly goods, Jews were told that they could live in Theresienstadt and be taken care of for the rest of their lives. However, what happened is that 60,000 people ended up living in a five-block radius, and typhus and disease were rampant.
And very short rations.
Very short rations, very poor conditions. Adler lived in Theresienstadt for 2.5 years, along with his wife and her parents. Eventually, he was deported to Auschwitz and Buchenwald. His wife he lost in Auschwitz. And he survives the war and is liberated by the Americans in 1945, after which he returns to Prague. And in 1947, emigrates to London and begins to write his novels about this experience. He ends up writing 6 novels in his lifetime, 26 books overall. He never held an official position, an official teaching position. He lived in London as a freelance writer and tutor, sort of rubbing 2 sticks together to make ends meet, and somehow was able to do it and wrote in a white heat, particularly during the 50s.
You say in your introduction to the book that this novel is as much about the soul and consciousness of the man who was possessed to write it as it is about the immediate suffering he endured himself. What do you mean by that?
Well, I think there are 2 levels of this novel. There's the content, the nightmarish content, obviously, the story of traveling to Theresienstadt, of surviving it, of going to a place like Auschwitz or Buchenwald and coming back from that as well. All of that is kind of there in the novel. None of these places are named. He creates fictional names for these places, and it follows a family called the Lustig family. And yet the novel is spoken from their perspective, from the guards' perspective, from the townspeople's perspective, from anonymous prisoners' perspective. It's multi-voiced, and sometimes you don't even know quite who's saying a certain sentence or speaking out loud. And that's very purposeful on his part. And I think of that Adler's mind and imagination sort of surrounds all of those voices or contains all of those voices. And if he's going to speak from his own consciousness and from sort of the inevitability of his consciousness, he has to speak through and of and by all of these voices. He has to use sort of every instrument in the orchestra, if you will, to make this work.
And it is a phenomenal voice and series of voices. The style of this novel is very striking. It is really original. I mean, we've already used the word surrealist. You called it a lyrical nightmare. Adler himself called it a tale with a further subtitle of a ballad, which sounds like music. Mm. What was he getting at here first? And then I'll have you read this passage, a piece from the book.
Well, I think there's a kind of, in the sense of a tale, there's almost, and this again sounds very strange, but almost like a fairy tale. There's a kind of, as we say in German, a Märchen, a fairy tale-like quality to the novel, to passages of the novel. There are sort of separate little fairy tales about different scenes in the novel, different themes that come up. There's also a kind of mythic level. Adler knew that he was writing about Theresienstadt and the experience that he had, but he also knew that this wasn't the last time this experience was going to happen, and that this experience was not unique, and that while this is the experience of what we have come to term the Holocaust, it has shown up in other places like, as we know, Rwanda or Srebrenica or Darfur. And this, unfortunately, is the 20th century, a story of systems which displace people, both physically and in their spirit as well, which systems which cease to recognize human beings as human beings. And we've seen this happen in the Soviet Union and, you know, countless other places across the planet. And he's trying to write that tale, the tale that would speak to all of those atrocities that somehow he could see were going to happen again. Elias Canetti particularly praised the book in these terms, saying, "You have written the story of displacement that will speak to all displacements from here on out."
And so here on page 23 to 24, I mean, as you mentioned, the displacement of people who are not seen as people. And this is rather a long passage, but I think it really shows both the voice in which he speaks as well as indicates the feeling that it is to experience this kind of displacement, this kind of rejection by society. So set us up first. Tell us what's going on here.
This is the place where the family and the other victims have been yanked out of their apartments in Stuttgart, which is the town that Adler uses, which, by the way, is the name of the street that Kafka grew up on. This is the way that he connects makes these little connections to the past and to the present history that, while it's a fictional name, it has some kind of irony to it. And they've been taken out of Stuttgart, and they are placed in something called the Technology Museum, which is, again, another kind of euphemistic way to think about this whole spirit, because if nothing else, the Holocaust is about the technology of death and how technology was used, you know, again, to alienate, displace, and ultimately kill human beings. And this is the part where they have left the Stuttgart, and they're beginning their journey. They're beginning to the long road of heading off towards Theresienstadt, which in the book is called Ruinthal.
And Ruhental means peaceful valley.
Yes, again, another irony. All that had been forbidden in the world now meant nothing, for it had never been a law, but rather an arrangement that rested on enforced custom. What was once taken in stride now appeared all of a piece to the law, which had the last word and did not allow anything to contradict it. Life was reduced to force, and the natural consequence was fear, which was bound up with constant danger in order to rule life with terror. You experienced what you never had before. You rejoiced over that which you were allowed, but even this did not last for long, because any such comforts had only to be noticed, and the next day they were taken away. Thus, the tender, juicy meat was taken away, since you, who are made of flesh, need no meat. Then they banned fat, for your belly was full of fat. They denied you vegetables, for they stunk when they rotted. They ripped chocolate out of your hands, fruit and wine as well. You were told that there wasn't any more. Highways and byways were forbidden. The days were shortened and the nights lengthened, not to mention that the night was forbidden and the day forbidden as well. Shops were forbidden, doctors, hospitals, vehicles, and resting places forbidden, all forbidden. Laundries were forbidden, libraries were forbidden, music was forbidden, dancing forbidden, shoes forbidden, baths forbidden. And as long as there still was money, it was forbidden. What was and what could be were forbidden. It was announced, what you can buy is forbidden, and you can't buy anything. Since people could no longer buy anything, they wanted to sell what they had, for they hoped to eke out a living from what they made off their belongings. Yet they were told, what you can sell is forbidden, and you are forbidden to sell anything. Thus everything became sadder, and they mourned their very lives. But they didn't want to take their lives, because that was forbidden.
The sense of the walls closing in here, of the progressive disappearance of human beings, throughout this book, there is a sense of unreality. You know, this is unbelievable. In fact, he talks about much about belief and how that creates a world and how this world that he's in cannot be believed in, and yet it's happening. Talk about this interplay between reality and belief for Adler in this novel, The Journey.
Well, I think it's one of the most interesting aspects about the novel is, for Adler, he says, we need belief to go on in the world. And if you think about it, he's quite right. I mean, I need to believe that I can walk out the door and get into my car and go do the things that I'm able to do and expect that nothing essentially surprising is going to happen and that it's going to be there. On the other hand, to live in such a nightmare system, how do you maintain belief and how do you even expect that life can go on? It's always very important to remember that, obviously, the Holocaust was not something that was known while it was happening. Human beings were put in dire circumstances, but they didn't know the end game, if you will, while it was happening. They certainly could figure out that this was very bad, and as when the death machine really began to operate, they did know, and it must have been nightmarish. But at the same time, the characters in this book continue to believe that there's some way out, some way that they will survive, some way that they can take care of each other, particularly as a family, that as long as they stay together and as long as they live for another day, they have belief and hope that somehow they're going to get through it. Sadly enough, the bulk of the characters do not. Paul, the son, the Lustig son, is the one who survives and returns, and in some way is the voice narrating the entire novel as a kind of stand-in for Adler himself.
And I'm talking with Peter Filkins. He's the translator of The Journey, a novel by H.G. Adler. Adler writes of this character, Paul, that, quote, he often thought the connection we feel to our surroundings is frequently built on belief. And I'm just going to read another couple of sentences from that page because I think it really illustrates what we're talking about here. He says, when this belief is violated, then the connection is already dissolved and the consequences are incalculable. And then he goes on, he says, it doesn't matter whether or not such belief is true, if indeed it exists only as belief, for it preserves much more than its possible truth, namely the truth of belief in itself.
Yes.
And here I'm stepping out to comment on this. It's as if belief holds the world together, holds together reality. You know, a few years ago, I remember when I saw the movie Life is Beautiful, and people all around me were just loving that movie. Yeah. And talking about how it showed the resilience of the human spirit and all that. And I frankly thought it was, and I'll use a German word here, Dreck.
Yes.
Because I felt it trivialized the suffering. It wasn't real. So what makes this kind of belief that Adler talks about and that he expresses in this book, and in fact through his very aesthetic, through the beauty of his language, what makes that true and the other not?
Well, I think the complexity of the novel, the way that it asks of the reader to maintain a kind of belief through hallucinatory passages, through passages which lead us into a kind of, I would say, lyrical confusion, because the novel never really quite lets go of you. It never leaves you behind and leaves you lost for connections. As the editor said when he first read the selection from it, that he and his fellow editors at Random House said that they knew what was going on, though they didn't always know what was happening. And I think that's a perfect illustration, or at least a window into the experience of the victims themselves. If you can imagine living under such conditions, you probably do know what's going on, but you don't know exactly what is happening. And I think problems, what you're talking about, the kind of Dreckish versions of Holocaust novels or films, too easily convince us that we know what is happening and we know everything that is going on, and they provide a sort of very safe and tidy formula for this experience. Adler doesn't do that. And at the same time, he has, I think that's the part of the lyrical nightmare. If you think about it, you know, a nightmare is where we are often confused and disoriented and don't know where we are and what's going on, but we're terrified at the same time. And lyricism is something that engages us, that lets us know that the rhythms of a poem or of a story are something that are familiar, that move us, that engage us, that make us want to go on, if you will, and find our way through the narrative and begin to order it and to shape it with our own imagination. Adler demands that of us. He doesn't let us be passive readers. We have to be active readers in engaging with this book.
Maybe you could read a passage that expresses that lyricism. And I was thinking about the passage that came just before the one you read, which shows reminds me in its personification of inanimate things, of that kind of lyricism.
Sure. The streets were quiet, heartened by the winter cold. The impact of the heavy steps pleased them, for that stamped life into them. Otherwise, the streets would have been sunk in sadness. They were forbidden streets, meant to be avoided in order not to violate their pavement. Thus, the streets were crossed out on the maps, no longer existing for anyone. It was too risky. Danger lay in wait there, especially at night. But one must not simply accept what is forbidden once you are not worth anything. And so the streets were there again, and were much longer and more beautiful than they had ever been before. They rejoiced at being granted life once again, and didn't ask to whom they owed their good fortune. Zerlina said earnestly to an intruder, "These streets are forbidden." But the stranger just smirked and rubbed his hands, because those words, so often repeated, no longer meant anything, for now the forbidden was allowed.
Yeah, and the streets rejoicing. You know, these are, after all, streets that Zerlina, who is Lustig's daughter, that they're going down as they go towards this technology museum prior to their deportation.
Yeah. Well, I think the role of the inanimate in the novel, that one of the central motifs is rubbish, because the Leo Lustig at Theresienstadt, like Adler, worked on the garbage detail, and the garbage wagons there were former funeral wagons, which they used to put the garbage onto and haul it out of town. And Adler very much plays upon this in saying that this is what's going to remain, that no matter how much atrocity goes on, there will be a residue of it, that garbage will be the residue left over, and that the axe cannot be hidden forever, which again is another form of belief. So that if inanimate objects can still have a life and a history to them, then there's still hope that the animate objects, if you will, in other words, human beings, will carry on as well.
Peter Filkins, talking about The Journey, the first in a semi-autobiographical trilogy by H.G. Adler, who died in 1988. We talked about the second novel in the trilogy, Panorama, during the first half of the show. We have a few minutes left, and I've got a preview for you of next week's show. We'll talk about two novels about the Vietnam War, each of which explores relationships between Americans and Vietnamese. The first is Tatiana Soli's novel, The Lotus Eaters, a New York Times notable book for 2010. It explores the story of three compelling characters, a seasoned journalist, Sam, his protege, Helen, and Sam's assistant, a Vietnamese man named Lin. Here's a clip from the interview about a pivotal incident in the novel where Helen is witness to the execution of an elderly villager by a South Vietnamese army captain.
You know, she's gone out on a couple of missions, and then, you know, and she's getting battered around and kind of, you know, ignored and made little of because she's a woman. And so she goes out, and this is the first actual thing that she captures on film where, you know, Americans go into a village, and also the South Vietnamese troops are in a village, and they, you know, terrorize the villagers, and an incident happens that kind of reveals what the real story is of the war compared to the story that, you know, is being told. And she happens to be the one who can capture that. And so there's the utter horror that she's, you know, her innocence is really being taken away because she sees what's happening. This is not, you know, the altruistic, you know, thing that you would read when you're back home. And she is in the position that she took the picture. And ironically, this is what makes her famous. And so if she had just been an observer and she saw something like this, maybe she would be disillusioned and she would go home. But instead, she becomes famous because she witnesses it. And so she wants to stay there even more. So there's this horrible kind of sickening push and pull that the darker the war gets, you know, the more she benefits from it in a strange way.
Yeah, and along with this evolution of her as a photographer, that is, in terms of her skill as a photographer, her maturity as a photographer, also comes this deepening understanding of the war, and that leads her into some pretty thorny moral territory. Say more about how she confronts her own role as a photographer, an American photographer, in this, I think we could say, colonial war.
Yes. What's fascinated me about Vietnam, as opposed to, you know, maybe doing a novel about a more current conflict, is that the wars before that, most of the coverage, you know, was patriotic, and they portrayed, you know, our side as, you know, the heroes, and that we were doing the good job. And, you know, the military and the government in the early days were saying that we were, you know, saving this country for democracy, and that we were, you know, the good guys. And this is one of the first times where the journalists actually saw something totally different on the ground, and they took pictures that turned public opinion back home. And so they did become the villains. I mean, the military thought that they lost the war because of the journalists being allowed to see things that they shouldn't see. And so there's a question for Helen, is that because she's recording this stuff and you know, getting famous off it and getting covers, is she benefiting and taking advantage of the situation in the same way as the military is? And I think it's a question that, you know, photographers always ask themselves. And I think, you know, what she comes up with and why she keeps on going is that if she doesn't cover it, that these atrocities and these things that happen will, you know, be buried forever and nobody will ever know about them. And when she records them and they go out into the world, you know, maybe she can, you know, change things.
Tatiana Soli talking about her best-selling novel, The Lotus Eaters. And here's a clip from our interview with David Rabe. His novel is Girl on the Road. It's about the developing relationship between a young American soldier and a Vietnamese bar girl, and how they struggle to find their own emotional truth in the midst of the conflict that rages around them. You have two main characters, both very, very different, except for the fact that they're both young. The first is Private Joe Whitaker, a truck mechanic working in a support unit in Vietnam. Tell us about him.
Well, he's as the term is, come down on orders to go to Vietnam, and he, it's very, very early in the war, so there's very little information about what he's going to be getting into. He just knows there's a war going on, and he's going to end up. He's someone who allowed himself to be drafted, and he's a person who, you know, wanted to go in and get a little learn a little bit more how to be a mechanic, and his idea was he'd go in and benefit and put in his 2 years and then come out of it. And so now he's got a very restless, somewhat angry personality. He's from the Midwest, from Wisconsin, kind of a farm family, although the farm's no longer quite functioning, right? And his dad is ill. He's got a chip on his shoulder about various things. But in spite of his anger and his so on, there's a deep kind of decency struggling to find its way out. But he's more or less committed to being probably tougher than he is.
Yeah, one really watches him, I think, throughout the book, struggling with himself. But, you know, especially in that first take, before he's really become challenged, as he does become so challenged later on, to reach more deeply into himself. Here's this, you know, young guy who's, you know, angry about a girlfriend who's broken up with him. She's gotten married, but he's still kind of attached to her. You know, he's really a welter of tender feelings and angry feelings, you know, kind of and very confused young man and kind of lonely. Is that right?
I think that's very good, yes. Yeah, it's probably more succinct than what I just went through and apt. You know, a lot of it is he's quite young, and I think a lot of that, both with the other character, Lon, too, they're very young and unformed in many ways, but put in situations that demand a character that they don't quite possess.
And tell us now about her. I mean, she, yes, also young, but seems as if she's much more connected to who she is at the core.
Yeah, I think that's true. I mean, Whitaker has a kind of dissonance with his brother at home, although he thinks he's affectionate, and he's very worried about his father, who's ill and in bed. And Lon is a young Vietnamese girl who was raised on a farm, and she's a farm girl who's now, her father's dead, and she's working as a prostitute and to get by and also to send money home to her mother and other family members. The place where she works is like a combo car wash whorehouse where GIs can come in and Vietnamese soldiers can come in and have their vehicles washed by these young boys while then they get some sort of sexual service. But she has a kind of buoyant spirit that tries to find a way to make the best of all this.
That's David Rabe talking about Girl on the Road. We'll be talking to him and to Tatiana Soli about her novel The Lotus Eaters next week on Writer's Voice. That's it this week for Writer's Voice. Go to writersvoice.net for more about today's shows. You'll find links to more information, web-only features, and you can sign up for our podcast and get connected on Twitter and Facebook. Thanks for listening. I'm your host, Francesca Rhiannon.